Welcome to the She Wore Black podcast. I'm Agatha Andrews. Today, Rose Sutherland joins me to talk about A Sweet Sting of Salt, her new book that's a historical fiction retelling of the Selkie Wife fairy tale. We discuss the origin story for this novel, her nuanced use of language, and creating queer stories with happy endings. I have A Sweet Sting of Salt in my bookshop if you want to support both the podcast as well as independent bookstores nationwide at bookshop.org/shop/sheworeblack. If you want another way to help out my show, you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads and leave me a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join my Patreon community, buy merch, or make a coffee donation through the links available on my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com. Thanks for joining me today. Now, on to the show. Well, Rose Sutherland, I am so excited to have you on. It's nice to be able to actually talk to you instead of laugh with you online without actually hearing your laugh. So it's a joy to have you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Like, this is a real treat. And it's nice to be able to see your face and not just flail in your DMs about ridiculous topics. So.
Fun topics. I love. So for anybody listening, Rose and I initially bonded over hysterical pulp cover of Interview with the Vampire. That was just the silliest thing ever. But I love that that's our origin story as friends.
Yeah, I know. It makes a good one. Well, and the fact is, you're not the first friend I've made over laughing about Interview with the Vampire. So, and hopefully you won't be the last either. So.
It's like a little club. Well, you're here today to talk about A Sweet Sting of Salt, which I didn't realize you were writing until you made your announcement. So, you know, I saw that and I was thrilled. I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that all this time we'd been laughing together, that you were working on this amazing book. So why don't you let my listeners know what this book is all about?
All right. So A Sweet Sting of Salt is a historical fiction reimagining of the folk tale of the Selkie wife, with a sapphic twist. There's a hint of fantasy to it. And it's all told from the point of view of a Nova Scotian midwife in the early 19th century.
Well, I love that what you've done with this book is create like a solid historical fiction. I mean, you could almost put it in historical fiction. There are times where I find things there that have a supernatural element, but are solid historical fiction, which is what you have. And though the Selkie is central to the plot, I wouldn't know that I would put it in fantasy because we are immersed in 19th century Canada. And I feel like authors that have really been exploring this way of writing myth and folklore in this context would be folks like Tim McGregor with Ein Hollow, which I did a comp on my socials with, you know, that book and your book.
And that instantly went on my to be read list because I actually haven't heard of that, but I was like, oh, really? And Frankenstein? Great, I'm in.
It is an excellent book. And when you read that book, you will be so pleased that I've comped that book to you because it's really wonderful. Alma Katsu's, of course, as we know, does a lot of kind of speculative historical horror. Hester Fox. Can you speak to your choice to center the historical over the fantasy?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of aspects to that, but the big one is, in fact, that when I first started writing it, my initial entry point to this book, the first person that came to me was Jean, this prickly, no-nonsense midwife. And the entire way I wrote it was that I was never going to give away that it was a folktale and that the reader was going to make this discovery along with Jean, or potentially maybe a couple scenes before she actually figured it out, assuming they knew the folktale well enough to pick up on things. And so my earliest beta readers were like, this is awesome, but also you can't bury the lead like that. Like, this is the selling feature.
Yeah.
So, you know, so there's a part of me that occasionally is a little bit disappointed that, of course, we have to lead with the whole, oh, you know, this is a reimagining of the Selkie wife and that people know that coming in, because I always thought it was really fun that I had been able to write what was essentially a work of very grounded historical fiction where the main character does not realize that they have brushed up against this folk tale and are slowly being pulled into its orbit.
I really like it though, the way that you went about this, because you'll have things in there that are like little breadcrumbs of what we're getting into. And of course, we know going in because of the way marketing works and everything, what it is. But it is such a wonderful treat to have this historical fiction novel. And then, like, it's bonus. It's like a bonus to have Selkie bits and pieces in there. And it's just, I really am enjoying authors playing in that sandbox right now.
It's honestly, that's kind of what I like too. Like, all of my favorite books in the realm of fantasy are the ones that read the most like they are just a slightly off-kilter version of history, like where they
Yes.
still have that level of grounding in the world that they're in, that they feel like they're either an alternate version of our world or that the world feels like it is already a deeply historical place.
Yeah, no, and it was super effective. I loved it. I love that it was Canadian, which we don't see a lot of, so that was also really nice. I always had this sort of dream of moving to Nova Scotia one day, especially during the Trump years. And I was like, maybe I'll just land in Nova Scotia. So it was just really kind of nice also to be immersed in a place I don't usually see in historical fiction or gothic fiction, and it's such a wonderful place for it.
It really, like, it really lent itself especially to the Selkie wife. But I mean, I
Yeah.
grew up there and I left home when I was like 18 to go to theater school. And I have never been able to fully move back for various reasons, mostly having to do with, work. And so, of course, the big hope here, fingers crossed, is, that maybe if this book does really well, that will help be the reason that I can finally move back home for good.
Yeah.
And yeah, once I'm there, if you feel the need to come get away, you're always welcome.
That's gonna be my in. So,
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
well, thank you for that. It gives me reassurance. I know you know my next question, and I know we both had a giggle about it. Because I love the origin story for the time in which you picked, which was the 1830s, and I thought it was inspired by the historical shipwreck that's in the book, but that's not it. Can you tell listeners what the origin story is for the time that you've set it in?
Absolutely. And I should point out here the historical shipwreck. I still started the story with that shipwreck when I had no idea that that specific shipwreck had happened at that point in time. I mapped the details onto it later when I found out about the real shipwreck. But I have been a part of the Les Mis fandom for ages and write fan fiction there. And I have no shame about it. I am cringe, but I am free. And so when I was like, oh, I want to write a story, I want it to be historical. And I was like, well, I've already absorbed so much stuff from the 1830s because 1832 is the same year as the student uprising in the novel Les Miserables. Funny enough, there's also another little Easter egg of Les Mis lore buried in the book. That I've been totally saving to tell you along with this. And it's that there's a fandom in joke about the fact that all of the students in that revolution go by their last names all the time. And so we were all like, oh, it's because they all have the same first name. They're just a whole bunch of French guys named Jean.
Yes.
And I needed a placeholder name when I was first like, oh, I'm just going to scrawl some stuff out and see what happens. And I need a name for this midwife. I was like, oh, I'll call her Jean. And then her name can be Jean too. So this was a joke. She, like everyone in Les Mis, is named Jean.
Fantastic. I love it so much. And, I have like all the because I really spent a lot of time in my art history degree within the 19th century, loved all of the French paintings from that time. And so I have a lot of visuals that play in my mind, with all of that. So it was such a joy to see the origin story. I was like, oh, that's kind of, and never have shame over fanfic.
And of course, I mean, the one thing I wish that I could have maybe leaned on a bit more is that the 1830s were absolutely wild in terms of fashion. But since I was both in rural Nova Scotia, which is not a super fancy place, and there was not loads and loads of money floating around, you know, we're talking fishermen and farmers. People weren't going to be going around wearing, you know, the ridiculous like sleeve plumpers and things like that in quite the same way. But I was really pleased that at one point Jean pulls out a Sunday best dress that she's never worn, and that I managed to just reference it having impractically fat sleeves, simply to be like, there, I managed to fit the fashion in for one hot second.
I love it though. I love how, yeah. And those are treats just for you, but if other people catch them, it's like a bonus. So
Yeah.
very nice.
Honestly, this whole book was about me writing treats just for me and hoping that other people would get it.
Yeah, no, I've heard that from quite a few authors where the first novel is kind of your id, you know, it's meant to be like, if you write nothing else that gets published, this is going to be the thing, you know, that you should just really write the one thing you really, really want to do. And, you know, I think it's pretty fabulous that this was your id.
No kidding. I mean, especially because when I first started writing it, I had no expectations of ever publishing it. I was like, oh, I just want to write it to see if I can. And then when I shared it with some of my friends who do write and were attempting to get published, I got told, no, really, you need to revise this, and really revise it, because I didn't have things like, you know, a subplot. It was very short. You know, and they very kindly, particularly my friend Jana Ginoel, was like, no, here, let me walk you through all the steps of all of the things you're going to have to do if you want to try and publish this. So it's all been a very big but lovely surprise to me that this is what's ended up happening. Like, it's just really been life-changing.
Bless the writing community.
And
Seriously.
no kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding. They're really great people.
Speculative fiction is really becoming a space where queer stories are booming. And I think in part because we can merge the real world with something that's also empowering. And so you'll get like elements of witchcraft or some sort of supernatural gift. But the Selkie story has never, to me, felt very empowering because she's held hostage by whoever steals the skin. And I won't give away how you change that because that's really important to this story. But
Right.
how did it occur to you to use a subjected folk character to do the same work?
I mean, to be fair, I hadn't really considered it that deeply when I first started. I was just like, oh, this is the fairy tale. And it was a fairy tale that had always kind of bothered me as a child. Like, I had found it upsetting, and in ways that, like, I mean, yes, the Selkie's been trapped, but I couldn't quite put my finger on exactly why I found it as disturbing as I did. And you know, at the end, there was this kind of sense that, you know, it's sad that the man has been left alone. And I was like, I don't like that. And when it came back to me again and was presented to me, I found myself sitting there being like, oh, I get why this disturbed me so much now. Now that I'm an adult, I see exactly what's so horrific about all of this. And I really started from a, like, okay, I want to find a way to give this Selkie a happy ending. Realistically, because I had also started very much with the knowledge that I had wanted to write a queer story that was centering two women, and had come up with this character of the midwife being the in to this story. I'm not surprised that there's a lot of space these days within speculative for queerness, because it so often addresses that notion of otherness.
Yes.
And a lot of people are like, well, how is my otherness a strength? And I think that's really part of what's been drawing queer people towards writing more of it. I mean, and it's also there in, like, the whole, and I mean, this has an element of it, although it's not strictly that, but like, creature romance.
Oh, yeah.
Is like, that's so very much about, like, embracing otherness and your own desires. And I think that's something that is really healing for a lot of queer people.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the other reasons why Gothic is also so big, because Gothic is centers agency, and like so that as you were saying, monster romance, like there's anything kind of speculative has been really interesting to watch because it is about taking back agency. It's about embracing, as you say, your own otherness, but it's also about empowering, because whether it's women, whether it's people of color, like there's anyone who's marginalized is finding, this wonderful creative way to take the power back, to quote Rage Against the Machine by accident.
Right. And I mean, it's just there's so much scope to put because it's one of those things like I have actually had here and there, I have seen people online be like, oh, I'm not sure if I want to read this book because it's historical and I know it's going to have a terrible ending. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. We refuse here. The whole point of this book was to give the gays everything they wanted.
Yay!
And hopefully everyone feels like I did in fact do that when they get to the end of it. But because in traditional historical, there have been, like, I mean, there are authors who managed to subvert that wonderfully. Like Sarah Waters is one of my favorite writers. And I remember Tipping the Velvet being like such a thing for me because I was like, oh, that was such a lovely, hopeful ending. And Fingersmith is one of my favorites of all time, and that has a happy ending. And I was like, there, look, you can have a happy ending for gay women in history. It is possible. All of my favorite period dramas do not have to keep doing me dirty. So I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. But I feel like for that particular reason, there are a lot of queer writers who tend to move more towards speculative than historical because they feel like there's more scope that way. And they can also do things like if you really don't want to have to address the fact that historically, homophobia was a problem, it still is a problem. That to be able to go, hey, we get a fantasy world too, is wonderful.
No, that's wonderful. I love that. I love that point, actually. That's a wonderful point. When it comes to historicals, because sometimes
Maybe
I
I want to
want
have a happy ending too. Okay, come on.
yeah, just sometimes, I'd like to
Now
not
and
feel
then, it's not
horrible.
that hard. I know lots of people who have had perfectly happy lives. Like, how about we do that?
Oh God. Yeah. So I know what you mean on that in that way, because I get that too. Well, one of the things that you did that I thought was really, really interesting was the way that you used the significance of language. You used it in a really powerful way. Jean kept trying to teach Mirren English while Mirren's husband kept trying to keep her not just isolated from the villagers, and he kept her isolated by stealing her seal skin so she kind of stuck with him, but he also tried to keep her isolated by language. He refused to teach her English, was upset with Jean when about teaching her English, and this felt as wicked as any kind of physical violence, because a person can't even ask for help without language, aside from just screaming. And so how did you arrive at this, especially since she did actually have members of the family, her own family, like that were also Selkie that could speak English?
So there is kind of an interesting thing there in that my first introduction to the thing that gave me the sudden like bolt from the blue idea, oh, I'm going to write a Selkie story, was a Tumblr post that introduced, and it was about modern fairy tale creatures. And it presented this image of Selkies testifying before the UN as human trafficking victims. Which I mean, and there's certainly an element in some cases of that that you hear of where people are like, oh, you arrive in another country, you don't speak the language, and therefore you are very much trapped. However, where it really started from was that I had read a book m many years ago. I can't even remember the name of the specific book. I remember the first book in the series. It was called Firethorn, I believe, by a Sarah Micklem. And at the very beginning of the second book in that series, the heroine is, I think she was struck by lightning or something, and she has to relearn it. It harms her ability to speak. And she has to basically relearn how to speak English and is coming out with things that aren't like, you know what she's thinking, but what comes out of her mouth isn't the same. But so when I first started, I was like, oh, well, this language barrier, like Selkies, obviously, I'm like, they must have their own language. It's not going to be English.
Yeah.
And this will make an interesting barrier for Jean and Mirren to have to navigate. And then as soon as I started writing it, it really quickly became clear to me just how insidious it was. And so being able to have that to lean on as like an extra tool of like control was it, like it really just upped the, I mean, I said insidious already, but really was just the insidious nature of everything that was going on in the house next door. Because you realize that on top of isolating her, it's like, and if she ever gets out of here, n she's not going to be able to communicate. But the language itself, though, when you mentioned the bit about the only one of Murin's relatives that speaks English is her uncle, who is
Yes.
human. So I created this idea, at least in my own head, that the common language between her uncle, who is has Gaelic as a first language and English as a second language, and the Selkies have Selkie as their first language and Gaelic as their second language. So presumably they all speak Gaelic with each other at home. And he's the only one who really speaks English. And as for Selkie itself, I have not really played around with that, except that in my mind, it is likely a unholy mix of both Irish and Scots Gaelic, and likely some things from Scandinavia and the Faroe Islands, where they also have a strong thread of this Selkie myth, and then seals, which adds a whole other layer.
One of the things you did that I thought was really interesting was it felt when I'm looking at her trying to learn English, of course, you have her with this broken language, this broken English language. One of the things that was very, very clear was how smart she was. And, you know, her husband would tell her privately, you know, that she wasn't smart or whatever it was to kind of also knock down her confidence, which is another abuser trait. But it reminded me a lot of, you know, especially like growing up in South Texas, but in Texas in general, you know, you do have a lot of people who speak Spanish first. And like this on my mother's side of the family, that was certainly true. My dad's family, not so much, but my mom's family, certainly true. But they've lived here for hundreds of years. They were just here first, but they still speak Spanish first. And one of the
Right.
things that was always so interesting to me is when I was in education, I was a teacher first and I was a librarian. You know, how often I would see students labeled illiterate, their parents also labeled illiterate, like on all this official paperwork and everything. Or if I knew that they were going to apply for jobs, they would be, labeled as illiterate, they could read. They just couldn't read English. But the label of illiteracy and therefore non-intelligence is the insinuation was always
Right.
there and they were treated that way. And I was like, but they can read and write a
It's,
different language, you know?
right. It,
And
and
so,
it's just another form of prejudice. Like,
and I saw her experiencing that. I saw, and I was like, that is a nuance that I picked up on because she's clearly a smart character, but she's learning English. And I was like, that was so smart of you to do it that way. Like the nuance was so real, you know?
No lie. Part of that is based in the fact that I ended up doing a French pastry internship wherein I was not expecting to get to go to France. It was an incredible bolt of luck. A great gift from one of my teachers at pastry school in Canada. But I realized with 3 months to this internship that got dropped into my lap that I was going to be living in a very small rural French town where no one was going to speak any English. And when I tell you the amount of cramming I did to become functional, and I am still not truly fluent by any means, But and just the sense of frustration I felt anytime I wanted to have a conversation with someone, because my first thought was, they're going to think I'm stupid because I can't express myself. Yet I had a conversation with someone once where I was like, there's a bird, and I don't know the name for that bird. I know the name for that bird in English, but in French, all birds are just a bird.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I feel like I must look so foolish or like a small child. And I mean, and I will admit, some of the way that that impacted my own ways of thinking very much comes out in Jean's refusal to like speak to Miran as anything less than an intelligent adult, because she just is like, oh God, I can imagine how frustrating that would be. And I'm like, yep, that's because it is.
Well, you have to have a lot of empathy to be able to kind of, because there's so many times, I think, especially in American culture, where people find it funny. Like, and it's in, or they make fun of people who aren't fluent. And I'm like, they know more about our language than you know about their language. So stop laughing.
Right.
So it
Like, I
was.
mean, there's room for humor in conversations where people are trying to speak more than one language because it can be funny. But there's a big difference between everyone laughing together at something and making fun of someone.
David Sedaris writing Me Talk Pretty one day and writing about his own experience living in rural France trying to learn French and saying, are them the thoughts of cows? Like, he's being self-deprecating and understanding, like, it's reflective on his own experience. And that's funny. It was a hysterical book, but it's context. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
Yeah.
I just thought
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
I appreciated that nuance. So
Oh.
well, the other
Well,
thing.
I'm glad.
Well,
I'm glad that worked for you.
I just thought it was brilliant. I just thought it was brilliant because I don't see that treatment a lot. So it was really good. Well, I also love a midwife story, which you gave us, and our main character is revered for her skill, but there are reasons, or a reason, that the village is also, a bunch of catty bitches.
Yeah, some more than others, but yeah.
They hold her in suspicion, if you will. And I feel like this is actually, I mean, when you look at history, always the precarious position of a midwife. They're revered when things are going well. When they're not going well, they're witches or, some terrible thing that they could get in, accused of being. But that isn't the case with your midwife. And I wanted to know if this was a conscious decision to use a beloved trope in a new way for this part of your story, because any suspicion she had nothing to do with her skill. And I thought that was really cool, like, just to kind of switch that up a little bit and show like a new way that a character like this could be revealed and suspected at the same time. I won't give things away.
Right. Now, it's funny because I hadn't really thought about it like that. Like, and I mean, I have often joked a few times that I'm like, oh, Jean has elements of the slightly witchy about her. Like, there's talk about her having magic hands because she's so good at what she does. But really, it's that she has worked so hard and is so obsessed with being useful and needed, and, so that she can't be, like, I mean, she can't be actually truly completely cast out. And the village does need her. And I mean, it does become clear over the course of the novel that not everyone actually, is as suspicious of her as she thinks. Which, may in fact stem from some of my own experiences as the odd girl out in a very small town when I was very young, because you get this sense when you are, say, bullied, that everyone must dislike you. And then you look back on it later and you're like, oh, actually, these people dislike me. These people just didn't say anything. And so I assumed that they must feel the same way. So a lot of Jean's isolation is, in fact, not all everyone else's fault. But the concept of Jean as midwife actually came out of the original folktale of the Sulky Wife. At the end of the story, there's always a child, which is part of the horrifying thing about the Sulky Wife and what that implies. But it's usually one of the Sulky's children who finds the sealskin and returns it to her. And as soon as I kind of parsed that, I was like, oh, well, there has to be a midwife. The main character is going to be the midwife who delivers the baby.
Yeah.
And so that was really where that came from at the outset, was her kind of both being the one to welcome the child and being in this unique position of being someone who's privy to a lot of women's issues and needs and concerns, and being able to help her in a way that perhaps no one else would have been.
I really love the way you wrote her too, be that the fact that she was so fiercely, I'm going to be the best at this. And she had a great teacher too. And I love that she was still a prominent part of the story, her teacher, the
Well, I
part.
love Annika. She's delightful.
No, that was really, I loved seeing that, because a lot of times when you read midwives in fiction too, you don't see their mentors there as much. It's usually just them on their own, and maybe they're training somebody else is what I see quite often. So it was really nice to see that she kind of had her as also a sort of a mother figure too. And I just really enjoyed having that
Yeah,
aspect there.
with Jean's age, like even though she had obviously started apprenticing to this very young, the fact is that she's still actually quite near the beginning of her career. So it makes sense that she's only been the village's sole midwife for the last maybe 4 or 5 years. So it's a whole thing where of course she'd go on leaning on her mentor. Who wouldn't? I mean, I have a writing mentor and I am telling you I must drive her nuts. Because I am in her inbox so often, being like, this is happening. What's going on? It made so much sense that she would continue to lean on someone in that position.
I loved it though, because in 1830s in a rural community, you don't know life expectancy and what that's going to look like for the people in the village. So that's why I was also like, yay, she still gets to have this person. Because,
Right.
it's a little rougher in 1830, so
Yeah. And no lie, I read some hair-raising accounts of midwives trying to attend people in like rural coastal villages and like on tiny islands and being like
oof.
lifted in baskets up and down cliffs and things like that. And I was like, I'm not putting in a scene like that in this book. It's not necessary. It's not needed. But also, ooh, I am real glad that was not my job and not then.
Right. You mentioned the child, like the Selkie's own children in the story, in the original folklore, finding the skin. And I remember seeing that. I used to be obsessed in the 90s when the movie came out, The Secret of Rowan Inish. I was
I only
obsessed
saw
with
that
him.
really recently.
Oh my God. I have that on VHS. And I mean, I watched it so many times. I was just obsessed with it. And it was just
Oh.
such a quiet movie. My child doesn't like loud, like superhero or cartoon kind of movies, because they're so loud. But that was one that was like a nice quiet movie that he enjoyed when I showed it to him. But I was like, this is such a lovely, it was so well done. But I do remember her children finding the skin, and that's why that mother like went back to her seal kin,
Right.
Like that.
It's funny though when you mentioned that and that being a really quiet movie, and it is, it's quiet and gentle and sweet. And a lot of my favorite movies are like that. Salty in a lot of ways is like that. It is a relatively quiet story. And I have considered that from the outset to be a feature and not a bug.
Oh, yeah.
But it is kind of interesting how often in publishing people are like, oh, like the number of rejections that I got were simply like, this is too quiet. This is too quiet. There's no place for a story that's so quiet.
That's wild to me. It's such a wonderful story.
People have their tastes. So I really wish that people would in fact make more room for these kind of quiet, more gently told things, because I think there is, and I mean it's not that there are not like exciting things that happen in this
No, it's a
story.
page turner, but it's
But just
not.
I feel like there really is a place for stories like that. But in the modern world, it seems like a lot of the time people are like, oh no, we need the Death Star to blow up in this movie, in every book. And I'm like, no, actually, there are times when that's not what you want.
Right. No, it was the last time I read a book that I felt I did a lot of I do st stand by my Ein Holo comp, but there's that winter aspect of it too. I mean, snow should be quiet. The environment should be quiet. I don't
Right.
know. Did you ever read The Snow Child by A.O.N. Ivey?
No, I haven't.
My God, that was the other book I thought about a lot with you when I
You're
was.
telling me I so you're telling me I should write that down and read that too then.
Oh my God. It's well, like yours, it's a retake on a fairy tale. And it's quiet. It's an American couple that goes to live in Alaska in the early 1900s, and kind of carve their place out in the wilderness. It's just this beautiful, wonderful story. It made me think of your book a lot.
Just as an aside, I think any time that you tell a story that leans a lot on nature,
Yeah.
you end up falling into some natural rhythms, and that does tend to, change the pacing and the
Yeah.
volume at which the story is told,
You need to read The Snow Child. It is gorgeous. It is such a good,
Okay.
gorgeous book. And it made me think. I thought about that book a lot while I was reading yours.
Okay, I'll check it out, and I'll check it out and report back when I get to the bottom of my currently burgeoning
That I'm not
TBR
helping.
list. That's okay. I always pray she got a good personal
I'm
recommendation.
so sorry. Well, are you at liberty, Rose, to tell us what's next?
Well, I have to play things a little bit close to my chest because we don't have anything official right
Okay.
now. But I am working on another historical with a folklore element to it.
I love it.
And this one is set in the mid-18th century in provincial France, actually in an area very near where I did my pastry internship. And it's based on a combination of a real unsolved French mystery from the time and a very specific subset of French folklore.
Very
And
cool.
that is all I will say about that for right now.
Okay, well, we're gonna get everybody very excited about a sweet sting of salt first. And I do
Right.
look forward to that cool French story because I do love a cool French folktale in the future. But in the meantime, congratulations on a sweet sting of salt. It is just beautiful, and I really hope like everybody picks up this book. It's just wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today on She Wore Black. If you like what you heard and want to support my work on the show, you can visit my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com for links to my Patreon, my coffee donation site, as well as my merch and my online bookshop. You can also help out the show by rating me on Apple and following me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and letting your friends know about the show. Thanks for joining me today, and happy reading.